Welcome to this class on teaching English punctuation. I wonder what you think when you think of punctuation. For me, is it a list of rules? Is it a list of symbols? Hard to do, hard to remember, hard to get correct? And is there really anyone who's exactly good with punctuation? I just had a conversation with Joel Schrock out there, and he's teaching this for the upper grades, and said, "How are you doing?" He said, "I don't know how I'm doing it." But an interesting thing he pointed out is he knows some of the best editors that know nothing about or less about the rules and more about how it comes together, and just it's an intuitive thing, this punctuation thing is. So I'm not sure which way exactly to approach it today, and how much rules to talk about, how much to talk about intuitive things. I want to take a kind of different approach and just back up and look at punctuation, kind of why we punctuate and where it came from. Then we're going to hit some rules, and then we're going to talk a little bit about where punctuation could be going. So where did this all start? And I'm going to read an article written by Keith Houston in BBC Culture. He says, "In the 3rd century BC in the Hellenistic Egyptian city of Alexandria, a librarian named Aristophanes had enough. He was chief of staff at the city's famous library, home to hundreds of thousands of scrolls, which were all frustratingly time-consuming to read. For as long as anyone could remember, the Greeks had written their texts so their letters ran together with no spaces or punctuation." So letter, 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 just letters across the page. "And without any distinction between lowercase and capitals. It was up to the reader to pick their way through this unforgiving mass of letters to discover where each word or sentence ended and the next began. Yet, the lack of punctuation in word spaces was not seen as a problem. In early democracies such as Greece and Rome, where elected officials debated, so spoke, to promote their points of view, eloquent and persuasive speech was considered more important than written language, and readers fully expected that they would have to pore over a scroll before reciting it in public. To be able to understand a text on the first reading was unheard of. When asked to read aloud from an unfamiliar document, a 2nd century writer named Aeschylus protested that he would mangle its meaning and emphasize its words incorrectly. When a bystander stepped in to read that document, instead he did exactly that." So what do you see there in the first part of this article is basically saying their words, the words they wrote, or words as themselves, need some kind of interpretation. They need a direction. They need an emphasis. And the early writers wouldn't even put spaces between their words, and then were proud of it. They said, "We don't want the page to tell you what to say. That's up to the reader. And I need to read this thing and interpret it. And if the page says, then I can't decide for myself." Maybe it's the same church structure thing that everybody struggles with today. Sometimes the structure is defined, then we know where to go with it. And if it's not, it's more difficult. So the interpretation was solely up to the reader to decipher and then imbibe that interpretation, preferably by studying the document beforehand. Reading on. Aristophanes' breakthrough was to suggest that readers could annotate, that old librarian, that they could annotate their documents, relieving the unbroken stream of text with dots of ink aligned with the middle, bottom, or top of each line. So they just had in your words, they put a dot there, or a dot center, or a dot at the top. Three different places of putting a dot at the end of each line. His subordinate, the bottom one, intermediate, and full points corresponded to the pauses of increasing length that a practiced reader would habitually insert between formal units of speech. And he called them called the comma, the colon, and the periodus. This was not quite punctuation as we know it. Aristophanes saw his work, his marks, as representing simple pauses rather than grammatical boundaries, but the seed had been planted. So he said, here's a good place to pause kind of as you're reading this. This doesn't mean the end of a thought. It means a place to pause. Unfortunately, not everyone was convinced of the value of this new invention. When the Romans overtook the Greeks as the preeminent empire builders of the ancient world, they abandoned Aristophanes' system of dots without a second thought. Cicero, for example, one of Rome's most famous public speakers, told his rapt audiences that the end of a sentence, quote, ought to be determined not by the speaker's pausing for breath, or by a stroke imposed by a copyist, so there you go, by someone putting comma on the page, but by a constraint of the rhythm. So he says, you know, this thing, we can't break it up, we can't put things between. And though the Romans had experimented for a while with separating words with dots, by the second century they had abandoned that too. The cult of public speaking was a strong one, to the extent that all reading was done aloud. Most scholars agree that the Greeks and Romans got around their lack of punctuation by murmuring aloud as they read through all texts of all kinds. So they would murmur, murmur, and then read what they read, and then murmur, murmur, and read what they read, because they had to like separate these things into words and make sense of it. It was the rise of quite a different kind of cult that resuscitated Aristophanes' foray into punctuation. As the Roman Empire crumpled in the 4th and 5th centuries, Rome's pagans found themselves fighting a losing battle against the new religion called Christianity. Whereas pagans had always passed along their traditions and cultures by word of mouth, Christians preferred to write down their Psalms and Gospels to better spread the Word of God. Books became an integral part of the Christian identity, acquiring decorative letters and paragraph marks, and many were lavishly illustrated with gold leaf and intricate paintings. As it spread across Europe, Christianity embraced writing and rejuvenated punctuation. In the 6th century, Christian writers began to punctuate their own works long before readers got their hands on them in order to protect their original meaning. Later, in the 7th century, Isidore of Seville, first an archbishop and later beatified to become a saint, though sadly not for his services to punctuation, described an updated version of Aristophanes' system in which he arranged the dots in order of height to indicate a short, medium, and long pauses respectively. So seeing what's going on here, suddenly the Christians came along and they wanted to write their beliefs instead of just telling stories. It's kind of storytelling culture before then. But not only did they want to write them, they knew that those Greeks that take it up and say the interpretation is up to the individual, the Christians said it can't be that way. The interpretation needs to be in the written word of God. So they said we need to put our own commas in so that the reader understands exactly what the word of God is saying, instead of trying to make it mean whatever he means by shifting the punctuation. So it's our fault, this punctuation thing. Moreover, Isidore explicitly connected punctuation with meaning. So here we go. For the first time, the rechristened subdistincto, or low point, no longer marked a simple pause, but was rather the signpost of a grammatical comma. So he says, we're going to make this a comma, it's not just a pause. So it means that we're getting kind of, this a group of thought. That's what we put commas behind. While the high point, or distinctive finalis, stood at the end of the sentences, spaces between words appeared soon after this. I don't know how you could punctuate before spaces, but an invention of Irish and Scottish monks trying to pry apart unfamiliar Latin words. And towards the end of the 8th century, in the country of Germany, the famed King Charlemagne ordered a monk named Alcuin to devise a unified alphabet of letters that could be read by his far-flung subjects, thus creating what we know as lowercase letters. Writing had come of age, and punctuation was an indispensable part of it. So why punctuate? It suddenly becomes very important to the Christians, whether their writing was punctuated, because punctuation is about a whole lot more than just a couple comma rules. I'm getting ahead of myself. Here's a little poem that has to do with the pauses, written in the 1800s by Cecil Hartley. The stop point out with truth the time of pause. A sentence doth require at every clause. At every comma, stop while one you count. At semicolon, two is the amount. A colon doth require the time of three. The period four, as learned men agree. So there we're still into this pause thing, that you pause longer to come. So you see, there's two ways of looking at this. Maybe it's supposed to be a pause thing. I feel like a punctuation has to do with where we pause when we read. But it also has to do with just the grammatical things of, you separate sentences with periods. After you have a complete thought and the thought has ended, your action is over and played out, you put a period on the end of the sentence. And I kind of look at it a little more that way. The same with commas. They group things together just for the sake of being orderly. So why punctuate? Lynn Truss in the book Eat, Shoots, and Leaves says, on the page, punctuation performs its grammatical function. But in the mind of the reader, it does more than that. It tells the reader how to hum the tune. So you see, punctuation isn't about time pauses and not necessarily even separating things. It's for sure not about having 13 rules for the use of commas. The reason we punctuate is to transfer meaning. Punctuation marks give a distinct meaning to those words themselves when we put them in. That's why I wrote this verse up here. For any of you in Jim Morrison's class on punctuation a couple years ago, I was going to contact him because he has that famous love letter between John and Mary. How many of you have seen that love letter between John and Mary, or John and somebody else? Between a guy and a girl. I'm not sure who they were. But it basically, the depending on how you punctuate the letter, the one of them is the one way he's so in love with her, and the other way he's so done with her. It just depends on where you put the periods and where you put the commas in and which way you read it. Totally mean something very different. This verse is NIV. I didn't mark it up. Not because I'm a fan of the NIV, but because in the King James Version, the actual words show you that it means something different. But in NIV, the sentence can mean fairly different things. Very significant for the way Anabaptists believe compared to Seventh-day Adventists and Mormons. Jesus answered him, "Truly I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise." And NIV puts a comma right here. King James does the very same thing. But if we would move that comma, so if you want to talk to somebody about soul sleep, so basically that the spirit leaves the body and it's somewhere other, and I'm not going to profess to know exactly what happens when a person dies and where they are. I like the statement that I've seen that says that we believe that when a person dies, they're in a Christian dies, they're in a state of conscious bliss with the Lord. I feel like that's a very, very good way of putting it. But you see the difference. So this is Christ, the thief on the cross. So he may have said, Jesus answered him, "Truly I tell you today, you will be with me in paradise. You know, sometime you're going to be with me up there." Or he can say, "Truly I tell you, today you'll be with me in paradise." So that's the verse that tells, this verse tells me that our loved ones who died and saved are with Christ today. Because Jesus said, he told the thief, he said, "Today you're going to be with me in paradise." That's hard to argue. Unless you would decide to move the comma. "Truly I tell you today." So this is something I'm telling you today. You're going to be with me in paradise. That is what the early Christians were worried about. Really. And that's the reason why we have this gift of punctuation. Is things like that mattered to them. They said, we don't want this gospel going out all over the place and making different sense to different people. Now I'd like to go into the nuts and bolts and just do a bit of a refresher, and we're going to run over these great rules for punctuation. And again, if you were in the other class you heard, I used the 5th and 6th grade English rod and staff books for this so that I hopefully wouldn't have to get too technical or into the difficult things. If you remember in the last class, some of you kind of cornered me on infinitives and gerunds, and we got in trouble until we remembered that this is not for upper grades. This is just 5th and 6th. We don't talk about them. And I don't want to be technical here either. I do want to just kind of run over and get some feedback from you if you could help me out. It's been after lunch. If you're like me, it's kind of a sleepy time of the day. So just call out. When do we use periods? End of sentences. And where else?
Abbreviations.
Abbreviations. Good. That's basically the two places. Ellipsis points. What are some punctuation for the end of sentences? Is it suitable to put a period there? What else? Got three more.
Question mark.
Question mark. Exclamation point. There are only three end punctuation things. Yes. I see my problem. I'm thinking imperative, interrogative, declarative, and whatever the other one is, sentence. I'm thinking of four sentence types and not there's only three punctuations. Thankfully, I'm glad. I'm not going to try to make a fourth one. The exclamation mark, interestingly enough, comes from the term note of admiration. And some people think that it came from the Latin word that means wonderment or joy. And that word is just it's an I and an O. And they think maybe someone just slid them. So it's Latin for joy, actually, the exclamation point is. I've had the privilege of this last hitting on the exclamation point is a pick of mine. Had the privilege of working with a very Pentecostal fellow most of the summer. And you know how Pentecostals are. Mennonites, for the most part, could use a little more charisma, but he got, partly through the summer, he got a smartphone. And instead of his flip phone, I don't know why. Yeah, he did tell me they needed internet for their house or this or that. So he would be there on the job and he would be saying, "Thank you very much, exclamation point. Praise the Lord, exclamation point. This and that, exclamation point." You know, his talk to text into his phone. And it was exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point. And I've seen those church letters you read sometimes, and every other sentence has an exclamation point. I find it personally very annoying. I think the exclamation points are joyful things, and we need to be joyful people. But just putting an exclamation point there never really made me any happier, unless it was something serious. I feel like exclamation marks are very easily overused. Where are some places where we use commas?
Compound sentence.
Good. I'm going to try to mark these off my list as we get them. So a compound sentence such as, can you give me an illustration?
I went to town the other day. I came home later.
Good. I went to town the other day. I came home later. That might actually be a semicolon in there because we need a conjunction and comma. Simple one students like is the dog, or students like, I use because it's easy. Students don't like it. The dog barked, comma, and the cat meowed. You can't get much using that, but a compound sentence. Very good. Where else do we use commas?
After yes or no.
Yes or no, at the beginning of a sentence. So sometimes instead of, like, after actually an interjection. Yes, I will go with you. Or no, I will not go with you. Where else?
Lists.
I'm going to take these in the order they came to my ears. So we took a dog, a cat, a canoe, something else on our trip.
Do you use the comma between the last two?
Do you use the comma between the last two? Good. So let's get an illustration.
Or is and enough?
Okay, we took a dog, a cat, apple. We took a dog, cat, apple, and elephant on our trip. Do we put a comma between this last one or not? Where's and enough?
I would.
You would?
Yes. It doesn't have to be. I think a lot of people wouldn't. I print a little paper for our church, a little 16-page monthly.
Mm.
And this is pretty relevant for me. I'm glad I could be here.
Oh,
hear what you have to say.
Oh, so you're going to stump me now. No, I'm glad you're here too. No comma in there. This is correct. Help me out if I say something wrong. I'm very fallible. I think grammatically it really shouldn't have a comma in there. Mm-hmm.
I would say it shouldn't.
Am I wrong?
I would too, but the and is supposed to serve. I think that's what they say.
The and does. There is.
The Rabbi Sapp teaches you would.
Really?
I believe that's the way it is. Someone can correct me if I'm wrong, but from my teaching experience.
Rebecca would also teach that you would.
The only time you would not is if you're having a series of compound words or compound thoughts. You know, and then I couldn't think of an illustration right off. But
okay, can I put up another sentence? And let's look at this. Where's my red marker? That's the one.
And I'm not trying to stress out the teacher.
No. These markers might stress me out. There was a red one around here before.
Oh, there's one on the floor up there.
Here we go. Let's change this to a con. This is the tricky one. I ate the third old red raggy apple. Where's the comma going here? And now I wonder if we're confusing this or not. Again, I'm very fallible. But the trick is that so a comma goes here and here. We don't have a raggy comma apple. Why does the comma not go between the third and the old? Good. Not descriptive. And you were going to say the same thing, I'm sure. It's the difference between limiting and descriptive adjectives. So a limiting adjective that tells which you ate does not need commas. But if it's descriptive, telling what kind of, then they do need commas. And this is the super test for your and, right? A comma should be able to be replaced by and, basically, in anything. I ate the third and old. That doesn't make sense. I ate the third old and red and raggy apple. So there your ands work. I know this one has stumped me in front of a class of students. And I'd rather be stumped here than there. As far as this one, we took a dog, cat, apple, and I just do not think a comma goes in there. And I am...
I think Theodore teaches it this way, but I know my writers do it because the other writers always catch me on that one, and so I think because the editors who have no experience in calling that wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So you need a comma.
They would say
I need a comma.
If it's two, you would. If you'd have only an apple and an elephant, then you would.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. So if you would only have two, for sure not.
Right. You get into and works.
So why?
I know Rod's staff. I'm pretty sure Rod's staff teaches that. I couldn't say for CIE.
Yeah.
Where do they store their books around here?
There's a whole bunch there.
They're not Rod's staff.
No, that's okay. Anyway, we can talk about
this. Actually, brings up a very, very good question, though. Again, at the end of the day. Is it important? To me, it kind of is because I'm a bit of a old fogey or like a rule freak. Like, if they used to do it this way, why don't we still do it this way? It's just like this new thing with, anyway, poetry. You string three or five words together and put spaces the right places, you can call it a poem today. They used to have to rhyme. And I don't know why they still don't rhyme. I appreciate Billy Collins' poetry, but... You didn't really need that little spout. But it's the same way. I feel like rules are good. They do hold it up. But at the end of the day, it's not worth that much. And maybe your students need a good dose of that whenever you're just sweating it out. You say, you know, it really doesn't matter. But we're going to try to play by the rules and teach the rules. Rules should be our guide, right? They should clarify things for us so that we know how to do it. But hopefully not confuse us.
I'm a bit confused on that. I must be the only one that teaches with descriptive adjectives, color, size, and number. You don't.
Color. So when would you?
You can. If you have two, describe it like snowy, windy day. Then you would, like, Oh.
So.
Third snowy day.
Interesting. So on the snowy, windy, but since these are because
one of
you
them
can,
is color size or number, you do not.
Mm-hmm. Because we said, see, and there's the problem. You should have been here for the parts of speech. This is the second problem with maybe punctuation. But you see, how do we decide if an adjective is descriptive or limiting? That's the burning question. Because does red mean what kind of, or does it mean which versus yellow? Right? Right? The third red apple. Which apple? The red one. Instead of what kind of apple? The red apple. So there where you're getting your... So CLE must teach that raggy wouldn't... Well, I guess it... Yeah, the windy, stormy day. Well, which day? It wasn't the sunny one. Okay, I can...
I just go by that.
Okay, so color, size, and number, you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm sure there's differences.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Rod Staff talks about it being limiting or descriptive, and limiting adjectives are the articles and the number. So it's third or first or two, and that's it for limiting adjectives, I believe, in those books. Very interesting things, though, and you see, I'm not sure where the standard is. And it's a shame that CLE and Rod Staff and AVBAC and everyone doesn't get their heads together and say, well, we're going to teach the next generation and fix their problems for them. Let's go on. Where else can we use commas?
After nouns of direct address.
Nouns of direct address. So, Robert, please bring me the ice cream, whatever. Robert, comma, after a noun of direct address. Where else? Dates, good. July 3, 1942. Where else?
After a town and a state.
Great. Addresses. So, he lived in Portland, comma, Oregon.
Put in a comma after Oregon, then, as if the sentence goes on. Mm-hmm. I would, but I don't know if. Has to be.
Okay. He lived in Portland, Oregon on July 2. This is no, yeah, this is an alibi. Does it get a comma after Oregon? It does.
I say yes.
Okay. You're all...
Unless it's a zip code after it, then you don't.
Okay.
That's what that teaches.
Okay. So commas after Portland, Oregon.
What's the difference?
It's a zip code. If it's small, like it's the address and the zip code after, then you do not put it in there. But otherwise, that's
Good, so we're going to all agree it does take a comma there. I'm going to agree with you. It actually feels wrong to me, but I'm quite sure you're right because, again, like semicolons then, if we go, he lived in Portland, Oregon, Portland, Oregon, Seattle, Washington, and we would list a few, then we would have to put a semicolon in there after the Oregon. So that tells me if we need something stronger in there because we already have a comma, then probably the comma was in there when we didn't need something stronger. I'm sure you're right. Good. And then we had another one for commas.
A positives.
Paul the Apostle is the favorite positive. Paul the Apostle preached the gospel, so Paul, comma, the apostle, comma, preached the gospel. Except that might be an exception. Just short appositives don't need them. Just the long ones do. So, John, comma, my third grade teacher, comma, preached the gospel. That would work more as commas. Or if you take it even further. Alexander, comma, my brother from New Hampshire, comma. Told us a story. So a positive is just, it's repeating. It's when we stutter, in case you need to refresh your course on a positive. So Paul the Apostle saying the same thing. It's kind of like my dad, he. more use for commas.
Before direct quotation,
Yeah.
Does it set off the rest of the sentence from the quotation?
Great. To set off the rest of the sentence from a quotation, Jesus answered him, comma.
Yeah, good.
Talking more about that, I guess let's jump. That connects right into apostrophes. And I think it's very important to drill this business right here. That's how it looks right. And the other way, it doesn't look right. And that's the only way I know to make sure that people do it right. It looks right always to do the comma before. These markers don't like me. To do the comma before the quotation mark instead of after. Just, you need to learn that it doesn't work to go quotation mark, comma. It's
right,
the
right.
Other way. Commas never, ever come after quotation marks.
Right.
And it follows at the end of the sentence, the period before.
Right. All punctuation comes before quotation marks. So period, quotation marks, except. More use of commas.
Seems like Rebecca had kind of a little thing in there that, like, well, whenever it makes it quick clear.
Whenever you need a comma to help make the sentence clear.
I think that would be okay.
Yeah, and that's why Leslie's saying he likes commas. which actually is very consistent, again, with the origins of punctuation.
Yeah.
They said, hey, we need something to clear it up.
Don't they say if you have commas in a compound sentence, for instance, if you have commas in those compound parts, you use a semicolon.
Right. Right. So, jumping on to semicolons a little bit, the dog, the big red angry dog barked, and the small, furry, whoops, stormy, windy, because we need to make this fit, a cat meowed. You need a semicolon in there. If there are commas in the rest of the sentence,
right,
compound sentences need semicolons instead of commas. Another place for commas, kind of consistent with this, just wherever it makes sense, is to set off words that interrupt the main thought of a sentence, and kind of like parenthetical elements. So that's something in the sentence that you could actually put in parentheses. I talked to my sister. She lives wherever and works wherever and all this other information we don't need before I went to the dentist. Right. So all that information after sister, you could put in parentheses, you could put in commas. There's all kinds of different rules. Basically, the comma is the weakest one. If it's just a little bit of information and it's fairly related, you're safe with commas. If it's further related away, then you need parentheses. I'm not going to talk about parentheses. I wasn't sure where to start and stop with punctuation either, because are parentheses punctuation? Yeah, they are. And we could go a long ways. Other things on commas. Is there anything harder to teach than the comma in English? Punctuation? Probably not. And it does annoy me, this thing of, well, I think it's the whole way through Rod and Staff's curriculum where you have, choose where the comma goes and write the rule number from the lesson that applies. And it's so good because it gets the students to go back and read the rules. That's what was the brain probably behind the question. But it's so annoying because it's not comma 5D. You know, it's comma rule 5. The D point under the 5 is why we're going to use a comma here. It's not about which rule it is. It is ultimately, but the rules sometimes can just get in the way. Although we've had arguments here and it were rules that solved our arguments, and then we find out the rules are different, limiting and descriptive adjectives. Another place for commas is end of letters and beginning of letters. Dear friend, comma, and then sincerely, comma, friendly letters. Apostrophes, when do we use apostrophes?
Contractions.
I can't. Can apostrophe T. Show possessive nouns. It was John's coat. John apostrophe S. Any other places?
I always thought when it was like that in
Correct. Good. So to talk about an item, his S's look like R's. S's look like R's. So we want to set off something to make it clear what we're talking about. I believe that's all we have for apostrophes. Oh, also, if you're talking about specific numbers, his fives, his anything, you put apostrophe S when you're speaking about them. I'm not going to go into all the possessive rules. Maybe we should hit quickly on the Moses and Jesus. It was Moses' coat. Moses' rod. This is fun. How do you spell Doris? Like this, right? If you're teaching Rod Staff English this year, open it up before you get to your book, or no, I forget. I'm not going to tell it to you like that. You will find Doris in your English book if you teach Rod Staff. You will find Doris in the 5th grade English book when you talk about apostrophes. You'll find her again in the 6th grade English book. And the 7th, and every English book has Doris in there. And I remember telling my students, like, we're teaching 6th grade, and they're just a couple lessons usually ahead of the 5th grade where they're going to be. And so we're teaching 5th grade, and I said, there's Doris in today's lesson, trust me, and you look out for her. And 5th graders, you're going to just come up in a couple weeks, and you're page back, yeah, there she is, they find her. The thing is, and I think it will help them with the whole Moses thing, because then their eyes are wide open. Doris apostrophe is always apostrophe S, and Moses is only apostrophe. The rule is, I'm falling back on Rod and Staff here again, but it's zus. It needs the zus sound. So rus isn't zus. So it's still apostrophe S. So you're going to have your students coming and saying Doris apostrophe instead of Doris apostrophe S. And it's Jesus and Moses just have your apostrophe. I think if you figure something out like that whole Doris thing, and if you look at your curriculum and find that they found one name that's this way, and then they're going to use that same name every lesson to test the students on, and then the students will be looking for that girl or boy or whoever they are, and it might help them out. It's not too complicated of a rule, but everybody's going to get it wrong. The rule saves the day here. Quotation marks. Punctuation always comes before the quotation, and then unless the whole sentence is a quotation or question. There we go. Did Father say feed the cows? So here your whole sentence is a question. Now, the burning question, and I'm not sure about myself, is do we put punctuation in here?
It would look like that was a question, and it's not. Feed the cows is not a question.
Right. So feed the cows is no question. So the question mark needs to go after the quotation.
Right.
But is there other punctuation in there? Don't think there is.
Come after say.
Yeah, you're right on this one. Come.
Thank you.
Did Father say, feed the cows?
But you only need one end mark at the end of the sentence.
Yeah, only need one end mark at the end of the sentence. So we can change this out to, did Father ask, did you feed the cows? That'll be the very same way.
Now that would have the question mark inside the quotation, wouldn't it?
But the whole thing is a question, too.
Did Father say, I see what you...
Did Father ask, did you feed the cows?
Boy.
Can we put two question marks there?
Avoid the situation.
Just avoid situation. And I think actually I think I can in this case. I doubt 5th and 6th would teach this, or middle grades might not be getting this technical yet. Not sure what we're calling middle grades yet. I'm pretty sure just a question mark at the end instead of one both places. But end punctuation, any punctuation, always comes before the quotation unless the entire sentence is like a question or an exclamation. So only questions and exclamations. You never, ever, ever put periods after quotation marks. Never, ever.
Right.
When, now moving on from that, when do we use hyphens?
Numbers 21 and 99.
Good, the number is 21 to 99, 20-1.
That's like one-third uses an adjective, right? One-third, not one-third of, but one-third majority. Then you put a hyphen in it, but maybe one, that's the middle grade.
One-third majority.
It's not like that before prepositional phrase. Mm-hmm. You never put a hyphen in
so
it.
So the vote was one-third...
Majority. Yeah, then you.
We go 1-3.
Yeah, but I'm not sure maybe that's above middle grade. I sound where your middle grade's coming in here.
Well, you're pulling a fast one on me. At least wasn't in the book I was looking at. But I think you're probably right. And we get into the whole hyphen thing. That's kind of tough too. I've just made way too many check marks on papers over this one. He carried a 5. 10 and 15 pound sack, and where you have a 5 pound sack would be a quotation. So these are potatoes, 5 pound. So we're carrying a 5 pound sack of potatoes, it's 5-pound. And then if you begin to put them in series, we carried a 1, 2, and 5 pound, it would be, and here again, I don't know what to do about the comma, it would be 1-2-and-5-pound sacks. This can be a little tricky, but since this compound thing got separated out, and we just did the first part, each part gets a hyphen. Other times we use hyphens. With self and great, so compound, my great-grandmother. This is a self-study course. Anywhere else we use hyphens?
Sister-in-law,
mother-in-law, good. More compound words. And to show connected verses, John 3:5-2, whatever. I see we're going to need to hurry a little bit. I'm just going to run down across the colons to refresh us. Colons, the greeting of a business letter. Dear sir, colon. I'm writing because whatever. When you write time, it's 6:10. 6:10 in the morning. And writing scripture references is another place to use colons. Here, I'm not getting into the other thing with colons. Except I really want to say what I've used for my students. When do you use a colon? We took the following items along on our trip. A dog, cat, an apple, and an umbrella. You would use a colon. But if you say, on our trip, we took a dog, cat, apple, and elephant, you would not use a colon. And that would befuddle. I don't think they teach that in the middle grades. I think it's more upper grades. It would befuddle everyone. But I say the colon is, it's like picture a conveyor belt when you dump it off. On our trip, we took the following. Dumping. Instead of, on our trip, we took a... It feels to me like an elevator, a conveyor belt, to just dump something off at the end, and then you need the colon. When you begin a list, you need a colon.
Am I right that you never put a colon after a verb or preposition? We did that last year.
Whoa. That's good stuff. No colons after verbs or prepositions. Okay, write that rule down and remember it. Semicolons, used between compound sentences in place of a conjunction, as we had earlier, and separate clauses when commas are being used already. Basically, semicolons are just superpowered commas. A little more before we open it up for final discussion, if we have time. Where is punctuation going? Or Are we done with punctuation? I watched a very, very interesting thing about emojis. So emojis are our new punctuation, right? We don't need to put exclamation points. We can put these wow faces or whatever these things that actually mean that. Anyway, did you know there's a whole committee that authorizes emojis? It's super interesting. Most notably, as far as where punctuation is going, the interrobang was a big thing, and that's the question mark exclamation point. And people thought that we need this maybe as a note of sarcasm. I'm just going to read right here. The concept came about in 1962 and was conceptualized by Martin Spector, the head of an advertising agency. For him, the interrobang would allow copywriters to put meaning to their copy for the reader. Despite being featured on some models of the Remington typewriter, it exists today in just a handful of fonts available from Microsoft Office. So they actually put these symbols on some typewriters. This is one way of writing them. Sometimes they wrote them just straight over top of each other. And then I think there's one like this that's just angular that would be in this thing's flipped up a little more. Interrobang, they call it. It's a question mark exclamation point. And it means, are you serious? I think Ron Staff says, just use an exclamation point. In 1966, the French author proposed a series of six innovative punctuation marks in his book, Plumens Ossia, Let's Pluck the Bird, in English. And these were the irony point. He thought we need an irony point, it looks like. It looks like this. He thought we needed a love point. Looks like this. We need a certitude point, which is basically this. An authority point is that way. An acclamation point. I guess this is a super-powered exclamation point. Oh, help. And we needed a doubt point. And this looks like the interrobang, pretty much. Are there any points you'd like to add? So we can go places with this. I do feel like the new age would be the emojis. And I want to tell a story about the emojis so badly. I watched this little video clip about emojis. And you can submit emojis to be put into the new fonts. So whenever they come out with the new software update or your thing, you'll have new emojis. And this one girl was talking about how she really wanted an IV bag emoji because the handicapped people don't have enough. There's like a wheelchair, but there's nothing else. So she was, and in the interview, she started crying. And she said, I don't want to be one of these weird people that cries about an emoji. Poor thing. And this other person really, really wanted, was it asparagus? I think, emoji. And someone asked him why, and he said, because it's delicious. That's all. But you can submit emojis if you want, and write up a paper and an argument why you feel like this needs to be a good emoji. And this certain committee of, it's very wrong, it's all white males, but they'll evaluate this thing and decide whether it goes into the new thing. Thank you so much for coming today. I hope you learned something.